Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the show. Every day I turn on cable news and nobody's interviewing Michael Hastings because he's not alive anymore. That is such a damned disappointment to me. That was always the highlight of my cable TV news day. The one of us who is so badass they have to let him on TV all the time. Yeah, well, so much for that. And I'm not suspicious about his death. I mean, to be suspicious would be the obvious thing. But his wife and his brother are both satisfied that he was having a real bad time and was probably just driving fast and wiped out. These things do happen. And if his brother says so, then, you know, I think that's about it. Anyway, but I really liked him, and I think that America and the world are just worse off without him. For example, think of the articles that he would have co-authored with Glenn Greenwald for BuzzFeed, the number one website in the world, had he lived this last year. The features he would have done for Rolling Stone and whoever else. He would have been in on it. He would be at The Intercept right now. And he would be on MSNBC going, no, no, no. That's a bunch of White House talking point nonsense. Here's what the real truth is, lady. Blam, blam, blam. Sheldon Richman would send me an email. Quick, Michael Hastings is about to be on MSNBC. Oh, really? Everybody shut up. Michael Hastings is fixing to be on. Damn, now those are good old days already? Jeez, what the hell kind of dark dystopian future is this we live in anyway? Don't even have Michael Hastings around anymore. Just these goofballs, these idiots with their nonsense. Five people on the screen talking about nothing at all. Joke. Anyway. So, that's the intro to today's show. all right. Eric Margolyes is going to be on the show. I'm going to ask him all about Ukraine. I believe it was a week ago I interviewed Eric Margolyes about Ukraine. Lots changed since then. So, I guess we're going to find out what's changed with Eric Margolyes. And also, you know, I have a couple of other invites out. I want to talk with John Pfeffer about the DPRK. Because I read something by some guy about the DPRK that got me wanting to interview John Pfeffer. I didn't really want to interview the guy that wrote the thing that I read. But I did want to interview John Pfeffer. I'll tell you why, especially because other than me, and maybe Gordon Prather, who's now retired, John Pfeffer is the number one lucky happy wish star winner best at explaining why North Korea's nukes are all George W. Bush's fault. He came in and he ruined a perfectly good deal with his stupid stupidity and his hubris and belligerence, and he pushed North Korea to nukes. And if I ask somebody, tell me that story, nobody knows how to answer that because nobody knows about that really. Very good, too much. But John Pfeffer knows. And it makes such a good kind of, you know, context. Such a good first answer when talking about issues of North Korea. Because it's a horrible, evil, communist, totalitarian state where people starve if they're lucky. And not just tortured to death. It's horrible. It's the worst kind of comic book communism you could think of. It's completely out of control. But that doesn't mean American intervention over there is, one, justified, or two, accomplishes anything that's any good for anybody. In fact, ask yourself, for example, why in the world does China not do anything? Why don't they want to help integrate? Why don't they work hard at integrating North Korea into the world economy? That's a huge export market, you know? I mean, obviously, there would be some disruption of refugees across the border, whatever, if communism fell apart in North Korea. But what they're really worried about is that North Korea would then reunite with South Korea, and then they would have the American military right there back on the Yalu River, like they once upon a time intervened to prevent from taking hold. And successfully. So that's what they're worried about. If the Americans weren't in Korea, if Ron Paul was our president and everybody knew that, yeah, and he's not putting them back either, then that would be, I'm not saying that would be the cure-all, but certainly that would be the removal of the single greatest incentive the Chinese have to continue to just barely prop up the North Korean communist dictatorship. And stuff like that that I expect a smart guy like John Pfeffer to say. He says stuff like that. He's a very smart guy. And very well-rounded on the American empire in the Pacific. These issues which get short shrift so much of the time due to all the focus on the Middle East. But anyway, so I'm trying to get him on. And then I also got to invite out to Marcy. Sure be nice if I could get her on because she is so freaking smart at this NSA stuff. You know what I really should do is I should tie my eyelids open like Clockwork Orange, and I should go back to June 6th, or was it 7th, of last year, 2013, from the moment the Snowden disclosures began in The Guardian and The Washington Post, and I should just reread everything she wrote, and then I should do it again. I bet by the end of that I'd be quarter smart about this stuff. Good enough to explain it well. But if you want to understand the NSA stuff, you want to get beyond just the headlines of the NSA stuff. It'll be difficult at first to catch up with her and know what she's talking about, but it's only because she's way, way, way out ahead. And I'm telling you, I already said this before. It's the smartest move Glenn Greenwald ever made was making sure that she was on board to be there. You know, Uber fact checker. I don't know exactly what her title is, but she's the one who's making sure that they're right about everything that they publish. And hallelujah. There is no one more well suited to the task that I've ever heard of. I mean, when you talk about reading through legislation and reading through legalese and reading through every last comma and semicolon of government propaganda and seeing all of it for exactly what it really is and understanding it all and putting it all in its proper context, there's just nobody like her. It's incredible. Emptywheel.net. And so I'm going to have her on, and I'm going to ask her about these last few of the Snowden revelations, of course. You always knew that your webcam was not secure, right? I mean, as you were sending whatever version of selfie over those webcams, you always knew it was not secure. Well, they've proven it, that boy is it not secure. And then if you want to share in the outrage, I couldn't do better than to recommend Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com. His latest piece is about Glenn Greenwald's latest, the latest of the Snowden revelations, or the webcam. I don't think anything's come out since the webcam thing in The Guardian yesterday by Spencer Ackerman. But this one is Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, was the next biggest one before that. Don't forget that they can hijack your phone and all those other stories from months back. All the Google Cloud seizures and everything. But anyway, how covert agents infiltrate the internet to manipulate, deceive, and destroy reputations. And this is a hell of a piece of work. In fact, I might just end up reading most of this thing on the show. I don't know, maybe not. But anyway, certainly it's very important for looking at, and I'm trying to get Marcy on to explain what it all means. And then she's also got some entries here about Executive Order 12333. Whenever an NSA official says, and anybody's mom ought to be able to understand this, right? Come on, this is how it works. Anytime an NSA official says that, hey, listen, we are not doing XYZ to your electronic communications, right? We are not listening to your calls. We are not harvesting your email. We are not collecting all of your Google search terms under the authority of Patriot Act Section 215. Then all they said was we're doing all those things under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. Oh, and if he didn't mean that, what he means is, oh, yeah, Executive Order 12333. Or some combination. In other words, just imagine Bill Clinton talking. Remember that time? Did anybody else memorize this? Let's see if I can still do this. It's been years since I thought of this. We'll see. I don't think that you can find any evidence of the fact that I changed American policy solely due to a campaign contribution from James Riotti. That was Bill Clinton. That's what these guys are. They're just liars, lying through all their is's. Like George Bush. Oh, it's not torture if we call it not torture. In other words, they're liars, all these guys. Because they're criminals.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I was at the dentist, and they're playing, I think it was the Go-Go's or Bananarama or one of those, We Got the Beat. I was like, oh, yeah, this is a Poison Idea song. Oh, yeah, no, I guess Poison Idea was covering them. Yeah, probably the other way around. Boy, those guys must have been high when they did that pajama party album, right? All right, well, anyway. I'm Scott, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, listen, so I just brought up Bill Clinton and James Riotti. I still nailed that quote after 15 years or whatever. I don't believe that you can find any evidence of the fact that I changed American policy solely because of a campaign contribution. Yeah, really, huh? Is also your ideological loyalty to foreign powers? Is that what you're invoking here or what? All right, I brought this up for you yesterday. Or was it the day before? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, it was yesterday. Today's the anniversary of the ATF's raid on the Branch Davidians. And I actually have a couple of things I want to say about that. Well, I'll get to the Clinton-Riotti thing in just one moment. There's just a couple of things I want to play for you. First of all, it occurred to me... Jeez, if I can find all this here. It occurred to me that this is actually probably not as big of a deal anymore as it used to be. That this will not actually sound that impressive. I mean, maybe it's just because so much time has gone on, but... the sound of the ATF's raid in front of you. But that's just another day at your local sheriff's department now, right? Yeah, cops, they're murderers. Everybody knows that. What's the big deal, Scott Horton? What's so shocking about the ATF pulling up in front of a compound made out of plywood full of women and children? And unloading as many rounds as all of them have combined on that house, shooting blindly through the walls, killing women and wounding children, killing innocent people. 6 Branch Davidians died, 4 ATF died in that original conflict there. And where that used to be the exception... it's sort of kind of proved the rule now. I mean, the reason for the siege was just that the Branch Davidians were well-armed enough to be able to fight back. and they actually won on that first day. And so it turned into a big siege. But otherwise, it's really, especially nowadays, 20 years later, it's not that remarkable of a thing anymore. But if you're in any doubt about whether, oh yeah, it was an ambush, that those Branch Davidian cultists lured the ATF out there to be slaughtered, well, here's Harvard-educated lawyer Wayne Martin from the inside of the building calling the local 911. Oh yeah, they'll help you. All right, and anyway, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and skip to the end here, just so you know. Here's Gene Cullen, CIA officer.
In mid-March 1993, I attended a senior executive staff meeting at CIA headquarters, and it involved senior agency management along with the liaison officers from the U.S. military, in particular from Delta Group. The briefing centered on Delta's operations in Waco, Texas. Originally, I was told that there was just going to be one or two Delta personnel there as observers, but during the briefing, it was mentioned that there was over 10 Delta operators at Waco, Texas, and they were not there merely as observers, but would be participating in any type of operational or tactical effort against the Branch Davidians. Approximately a year after the Waco incident, I was deployed overseas in Europe, and I had the chance to meet some of the Delta operators that I had met on previous assignments. They had told me on several different occasions during my meetings with them in Europe that not only were they forwardly deployed at Waco, Texas, but they were actually involved in a gunfight with the Branch Davidians.
All right, and then here is Stephen Berry, former Special Forces. I forget if he was Navy SEAL or Delta Force. I believe he's former Delta Force himself.
But I did talk to some Combat Applications Group guys, and they did confirm that, yes, portions of the B Squadron were there pulling triggers.
And then, like I was saying yesterday,
if Combat Applications Group was on the ground that day, actually pulling triggers, the origin of that operation would have come directly from the White House. It would have come from the President. Because Combat Applications Group is, for all intents and purposes, the President's private army.
Oh, yeah, no, it was Janet Reno's fault. And now here's Gene Cullen, CIA officer again.
It was discussed at the meeting that the senior levels of the Clinton administration had authorized Delta to be deployed to Waco, Texas, and not just two or three people deployed there, but enough people there to get the job done.
Yeah, the job done. And then now here's the part where, oh, God, if I can find the damn clip now. It's a Fox News clip of Britt Hume talking about, man, I got too many clips and they're all lowercase titles here. Where the hell was it? Is Clinton admits it or where is it? For Christ's sake. Well, let's see. I wonder if I just rewind all the way back, if it'll go back and play it, because I had it before. Yeah, here it is right here.
Now, David, the President said something about Waco in this interview, correct? That seems to have some people interested. What's that all about?
Well, Britt, James Riotti was at the White House on April the 19th, 1993, the day that the Branch Davidian compound in Waco burned to the ground. Mr. Clinton, in talking about that day to investigators, suggested the tragic outcome wasn't his fault, though he does take some responsibility. Mr. Clinton testified, quote, I gave in to the people in the Justice Department who were pleading to go in early, and I felt personally responsible for what happened, and I still do. I made a terrible mistake. Officials at the Justice Department were caught by surprise by the president's statement. They say that Attorney General Reno and Webster Hubbell, a longtime Clinton friend who was in charge of the Waco standoff coming to an end, consulted with the president but didn't have to twist any arms. They say that they consulted with the president merely to apprise him of the situation, but not to get his permission. They suggest that Mr. Clinton's suggestion that he gave in to the people who wanted to go in early is simply not accurate. Britt.
David, thank you very much. Coming up next, Bill Kristol on Dick Cheney. Be right back.
Bill Kristol on Dick Cheney. Coming up next, everybody. So there you go. Bill Clinton was being sued for, hey, what's this James Reality character doing at the White House all the time? And it turns out that Bill Clinton was watching Waco burn with James Reality. Hey, you go back, you tell Zhang Zemin, you tell him this is how we treat unlicensed Christians in America, just like in China. Thanks for the money. I'm going to buy some TV ads with it and put your guy Wong in the Commerce Department to license transfers of missile technology. It'll be great. As Waco was burning. So that's how we know. And then talk about besides the point. Bill Clinton says, yeah, I ordered it, all right. I'm 100% guilty as hell of murdering 90 people. No doubt about that. But I feel a little bit bad because I gave in to the Justice Department. They made me do it. And then the Justice Department says, we didn't make him do it. We just asked him. And he was like, yeah, all right then. And then so we did it. But of course, the Justice Department is not the boss of the Delta Force, ever. The Combat Applications Group, Team B, Waco Butchers. They don't work for the FBI or the ATF. Janet Reno, or who was the Secretary of Treasury in 93, I forget. No. That was Bill Clinton murdered those people. And you know what? The American people loved it. And maybe the poll was a lie that 93% of the American people supported the raid with tanks on a house full of women and children that one way or the other culminated in them being burnt to death. Never mind machine gun if they were at the back of the house. Maybe they lied by 10 points. Maybe they lied by 20. Maybe it was only 73% of the American people who supported it. But the consensus was, yeah, kill them. And then the consensus was, oh, good, they finally killed those people. I'm so sick of that thing on TV all the time. And that's why you live in a totalitarian police state today. Because, you know, those Branch Davidians, they're different from you. And so rights are something that don't quite apply to them, right? After all, half of them were black, so they're starting off way behind the curve and having rights respected right there. I know they tried to spin it like they were a bunch of white supremacists or something, but half of them were black. Although you didn't see Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton coming to their defense. Because it was the Democrats who were murdering them, of course. But anyway, that was the poll in USA Today, 93%. And I've told the story before, but I'll tell it again because to me it's important and I'll never forget it. That I was sacking groceries at the time. I was 15 years old, or maybe I just turned 16 or something. I don't know. Anyway, I was a kid and I was sacking groceries at the grocery store. And all the upper middle class housewives from Northwest Austin were unanimous that each and every one of these people ought to be taken out and shot or drop a bomb on them or whatever it is to get their prices right and their one life to live back on TV. They didn't care if little children had to burn to death. It was their mandate to burn those children. It really was. And Bill Clinton carried it out.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org, LibertyExpressRadio.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, /Scott Horton Show, and et cetera like that. Hey, you got a search engine, man. You can find it. All right, first up, our guest today is Eric Margolies, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. His website is ericmargolies.com, spelled like Margolis, and he also writes for lewrockwell.com and for unz.com. That's UNZ, unz.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Eric?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm watching all this fast-breaking news with fascination and trepidation.
All right. Well, if I remember right, it was last Friday was our last interview, and it started with, oh, good, they've worked out some kind of interim deal, and they're going to have some elections. And, I think as soon as the interview was over, the coup d'etat was on. Why don't you catch us up?
What looked like a possible settlement negotiated by the EU to Ukraine's ongoing crisis fell apart immediately as militant demonstrators rejected it. I'm talking in Kiev, Then Ukrainian president, maybe he still is, was ousted, fled for his life from Kiev. A new parliament was elected with a new speaker, all part of the militant nationalist Ukrainian movements. And the rest of Ukrainian, the Russian-speaking part of Ukrainian, said, no way, we're not going to go along with it. And trouble's broken out there now. It's a very dangerous situation.
Now, I guess one obvious question that jumps out at me is whether, you know, the so-called coalition, whoever they are, the American bankrolled types who are taking over the government now, whether they will have the strength to actually exercise monopoly control over the East, or whether they're just going to end up having a sort of de facto autonomy anyway. How powerful is their national police force? How powerful is their army? And can they enforce monopoly state rule over the East, or have they done this too many times and now they're just going to sort of kind of de facto break up anyway?
Well, we just don't know at this point. The army so far has stayed out of the political turmoil. Its commander just said a day or two ago that it would not intervene in the fighting, and it would definitely not, but it would oppose Russian troops if they entered into Ukraine. But we don't know what the rank and file in the army has to say, because it probably mirrors the same ethnic, cultural, political splits that the rest of the country does. And meanwhile, while this is going on, Russia has just mobilized 150,000 troops in its western regions within more or less striking distance of Ukraine. I think this was an inevitable development. Yanukovych, the deposed president, has showed up in Russia, in Rostov-on-Don, claiming that he was hard done by and he's still the president. Putin, who's playing a very cagey game, had nothing to say on the subject and hasn't even met with him. He's wildly reviled as a coward and incompetent. And meanwhile, gangs, heavily armed gangs in Crimea, are seizing government buildings, and there are reports that they and or some Russian troops have taken positions around Crimea's two main airports. There's a very strong pro-Russian move in Crimea, which is almost 80% ethnic Russian, and was only given to Ukraine, which was then a Soviet Socialist Republic in 1954, by Nikita Khrushchev, reportedly when he was drunk. And there's no reason for Crimea to be in Ukraine. It's a very strategic location with its great port at Sevastopol. And there the tensions stay. It's very frightening, because what I've been warning about for months and months is that these events are putting the Western powers and Russia on a collision course.
All right, now I'm trying to put myself in Putin's shoes, but I'm not very good at that because I don't know much about being the autocrat of Russia or anything like that. But I did see this guy, I don't know his name, I don't know if he has one, but they said he was, I believe they said he was the editor of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, and so not the neocon wackos, but more of the centrist establishment, although there are some neocon kooks live there, like Abrams and Boot and, I guess, Crystal sometime. But anyway, this guy didn't seem like much of a neocon. He was just, you know, a plain old vanilla State Department type or something. And he was saying, I think to Jon Stewart, that, oh, yeah, while Putin's looking the other way at the Olympics, we're running off with Ukraine, and aren't we clever, and this kind of thing. And I was thinking that if I was Putin, I might not even waste more than half of a chuckle at that, and then I might wait these guys out for 3 or 4 weeks until their plan falls apart, because what possible influence can America really maintain in Ukraine when it is, in fact, Russia's backyard?
Well, we could have a military influence if we want to face a war with Russia, which would be beyond idiotic, since we're both nuclear-armed powers. I wrote last year already that if things aren't diplomatically resolved in Ukraine, we could be facing another Cuban Missile Crisis. We don't want that. I'm not ready to die for Kiev or Dnipropetrovsk. And most Americans, 90% of Americans, couldn't find Ukraine on a map if their lives depended on it. But that's the case. But the other influence is money. Ukraine is 44 million people. It's completely bankrupt. It's literally down to its last few dollars of reserves. Putin offered $15 billion to bail them out alone, which is not enough. But Europe wouldn't even match that offer, it seems. Now it's a ping-pong game of who can bail out Ukraine better. But in my view, the Ukrainian finance minister just said, of the new government, just said that Ukraine would need a minimum of $35 billion just to keep its head above water. And who in his right mind would lend money to a country like this that doesn't really have an established government, that's a chaos, nobody knows who's in charge, and it's filled with, you know, angry, disgruntled people? So you're facing, you're having both a political crisis and a financial crisis at the same time.
Right, well, I mean, isn't the easy answer the American taxpayer, who, and they're not in their right mind, but all they got to do is, really, all Obama has to do is go ask Janet Yellen for the checkbook and go over
print
there and
money.
Pay off whoever he needs to, and it'll cost us in the unemployment line later. But
yeah, you know, the only bright side of this crisis is that Ukraine in 1991 had nuclear weapons as part of the Soviet military, and Ukraine got rid of them. They sold them for money to the Americans. It's a good thing they don't have them today. Otherwise, we'd really be worried.
Yeah, did you see where Josh Rogan had that thing in the Daily Beast about these Republicans openly saying, we wish the Cold War was here, because then, you know, everybody knew where everybody stood and all this, and they didn't really realize that these idiots, that their real argument is, if the Soviets completely and totally dominated all of Eastern Europe, that would be effective at keeping us from meddling where we don't belong. But since the Soviets aren't here to stop us, here we are screwing up everything. That's their complaint.
You know, I've often said that the fall of the Soviet Union unbalanced the world political order, and Putin said the same thing. I'm not saying that Soviet Union was a good thing. It was an evil empire in many ways, but as Reagan called it. But it certainly left the United States with unlimited power, and we know that unlimited power, absolute power, corrupts absolutely. We violated our agreements with Mikhail Gorbachev not to expand NATO. We're right on Russia's doorstep now. We're trying to take away its historical heartland, Ukraine. And I'm really concerned. I mean, Ukraine means an enormous amount to Russia. It's like a foreign power trying to take Texas away from the United States. The Russians are going to dig in their heels. So far, the Russian response has been very measured and reserved, but emotions are at play here.
Well, so, I mean, I guess there is no status quo, really. It's a fluid situation, but would you bet on the likelihood of Russian military intervention?
Oh, I'd give it a 50% probability.
Jesus.
and the U.S. would then be confronted by an awful decision. What's it going to do? Okay, big talker. I wrote a couple of weeks ago, the president, our president, said, you know, warn the Russians, keep your hands off Ukraine or there will be consequences. Well, okay, big talker, here they are. What are the consequences?
Right.
You know, you're going to go to
Democrats
war.
Democrats sure are tough guys, aren't they?
Yeah. So it's dangerous. There's a looming civil war in Ukraine between the eastern and western portions. You know, my own view, my Ukrainian friends will skin me alive for saying this, but I really think Ukraine, probably the ultimate, the best solution to this is a peaceful division of Ukraine into western Ukrainian-speaking regions and the eastern, which are totally Russian areas, Russian-speaking, historically Russian, and which are completely wired into Russian industry. So, and to divide the two and let the Russians have the east and let whoever the hell wants and can afford western Ukraine to have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that's going on here, too, I saw, and I don't know how representative this is, although accusations sure fly a lot, but I saw a picture of these Ukrainian brown shirts beating up an old woman, kicking her, and she looked pretty damn old, too. And it says, well, she was on her way to deliver flowers to the Lenin statue, and so they were beating her ass. And so you really have, not like in America where everybody just calls each other names, you really have, to some degree, the commies versus the Nazis on the ground there, which means really hard feelings going back to World War II, who sided with Hitler and who sided with Stalin. And so how are people like that, you know, when those are at least, you know, a part of what defines them, if not what they're fighting about today, you know, in terms of policy. They're more fighting about who has the power is all, but when it's that's who versus who, how are you going to have a democracy of compromise with a situation like that, right?
Right.
Got to split them up. All right, now hold it right there. It's the commercial break. We got to go out to it, and we'll be right back with the great Eric Margolies, author of American Raj, right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. You can retweet my brilliance at twitter.com/Scott Horton Show if you want. You also check out Eric Margolies on Twitter, at Eric Margolies. Spell it like Margolis. I got one commenter who hates it when I say that. Well, how else are you supposed to spell it? Like Margolies? That don't make any sense. Welcome back. It's the show. Now, Eric, all this talk about commies and Nazis, it's really bad of me. It's dumb of me to go out to a break calling people commies and Nazis and then not able to, you know, have it explain what exactly we're talking about here. Can you fill me in? Especially, I've seen the evidence of the Nazis on the street out there with their SS lightning bolts and their, you know, Hitler salutes and their Iron Crosses everywhere. I don't know. I guess I saw a couple of swastikas. And there are a couple of reports of somebody tried to firebomb a synagogue or a Jewish school or something like that. I don't really know. And I don't know too much about who all still loves Lenin and Stalin in Ukraine, but maybe they do. Can you fill us in on who these people are and why they hate each other so much?
Yes, Scott. First thing, starting point is we've got to remember that Stalin in the 1930s murdered between 6 and 7 or 8 million Ukrainians by shooting them or starving them to death. There was widespread cannibalism in the Ukraine. It was a campaign designed by the Soviet Eichmann, whose name was Lazar Kaganovich, to break the spirit of the independent farmers in Ukraine. So Ukraine suffered mass genocide, a Holocaust, in fact, long before anybody ever heard of Adolf Hitler. We were allied to the same country in World War II that committed this monstrous crime. Today, unfortunately, everybody's using these terms, fascists, Nazis, commies like that, but there really aren't many communists left. Everybody's disillusioned with communism. And the Russians and the Ukrainian, pro-Soviet Ukrainians, are calling everybody who opposes them a fascist, gangster, bandit, black shirts and that kind of thing, brown shirts. But it's not true. It is very much exaggerated. There are some street thugs who you'll find in Kiev and other cities who use Nazi salutes and beat up people. You also find them in Moscow in great numbers, and you find them in Europe as well. I mean, these are street hooligans. Scum of the gutter, as my mother used to call them. But they don't dominate the Ukrainian political process. Most its leaders are nationalists who desperately want an independent state free from Russia.
Real fascists, guys with bank accounts.
Well, that's different. But the so-called fascists are not fascists, and they hark back to the Ukrainian resistance movement against the Soviet rule in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Its leaders were murdered mostly by the Soviet secret police. They sided for a while with the Germans in 1941 and 42, as did many other European countries. So the same thing happened in Yugoslavia and Belgium and Holland. But they were not doing it because they were Nazis, but because they wanted to throw the Russians out. And at that time, the Germans looked like liberators.
Yeah, well, and that's part of the story of World War II, of all the different peoples, as they're collectively called, stuck between the Nazis and the communists during World War II is, you know, you do what you have to survive under the Nazis. Then when the Russians show up, you got to explain how come you're still alive, that you must have gotten along with the Nazis while they were here, and then vice versa again when it switches back again.
Exactly.
A lot of innocent people died over stuff like that.
We, the United States, collaborated with the biggest mass killers in history, which was the Soviet Union.
Yeah, including even after the war with Operation Keelhaul.
Yes.
Man, you want to tell them about that, since I brought it up and it's the most horrible thing any American president ever did that I can think of?
Yeah, you're referring to the British handover of the Cossacks?
Well, Truman's. Some of them were in the United States, I believe, were drugged up and you know, tied up and put on ships and sent back to Stalin after the war, the POW.
Yes, the British were even worse with this. Many of the groups had been fighting the communists, notably the Cossacks, Russian Cossacks, and Muslim groups, who had fled to the British and the American lines for safety, and French units fighting for the Germans were all handed back, and they were all shot.
Yeah.
In great numbers.
Yeah, Jacob Hornberger has a great, I think, 6 or 7 part series or something, all about Keel Hall, and I think he counts 2 million people, something like that. 2 million prisoners of war handed back to Stalin to be shot. Where, right, if you surrender, if you're in Stalin's army and you surrender, that's a capital offense. Whether you got a rifle in your hand or not, you're not allowed to surrender to the Germans, and because we're going to kill you anyway, kind of thing. So each and every one of them that were sent back were all guilty of the capital crime of surrender, basically.
That's correct. Even Stalin's son was captured, and when Stalin heard that, he said something like, well, I hope he dies. That was the policy. So we have much to be ashamed of, but we're still overcome by war propaganda. It's going to take years more for some more truth to emerge.
Yeah. But so where you have some of these brown shirts running around in the street with their baseball bats and all of that, you wouldn't put too much stock in their rise to power or anything. These are just... they're the useful street toughs for the coup for now, and then they'll melt away, or what?
I believe so. We see the same type of young men in at the barricades in Spain and in Italy and Germany, and you name it. There's just a lumpen proletariat of violent people. We see them in Paris, too, who are ready to riot. The French call them casseurs. Breakers. They're ready to just go and smash things and throw Molotov cocktails. But the upper echelons of the Ukrainian nationalist movement are not street thugs and are certainly more thoughtful. It would be wrong to dismiss them as fascists.
All right, now, so the Russians already have this giant base, naval base in Crimea, and I guess their lease expires in 2043 or something like that, so that's not going anywhere. I don't know. What do you expect? You think Putin's just going to maybe park some more boats there and make it a little bit more difficult for the Americans to really think about trying to push their luck when it comes to special Crimea?
I've toured the whole naval base at Sevastopol. It's quite fascinating. It's huge. It's beautiful. Beautiful natural harbor. And it contains most of the Soviet Black Sea Fleet, which is tasked with transiting the Dardanelles and going into the Mediterranean. So this is their opening to the Mediterranean and Indian Ocean, for example. They have only one other major naval base on the Black Sea, and that's at Novorossiysk. This is vital. This is a vital Russian interest. The Russians have a lot of ships there. They have troops. It's an extraterritorial area, sort of like their Guantanamo. They've made clear that there's no way that they're going to give up this base. And I'm convinced that the Russians would fight to defend it.
Well, that Barack Obama, he backs down on everything good he ever said he was going to do, except the Iran talk so far, I guess. Now, I mean, he backed down in 2009 and 2010 when he could have made it happen, so don't get me wrong. But he seems to follow through on all his worst stuff most of the time, like surging into Afghanistan or, you know, that kind of thing.
Guantanamo's
still open, but I guess, I don't know, I sort of have faith in his cowardice that he's not going to push his luck here and get himself and the rest of us killed messing with the Russians, right?
Well, I hope so. That's the only good thing I could ever say about Bill Clinton, too. He didn't get us into a major war. But these Republicans in Congress are very warlike. They are thirsting for the Cold War, as you were saying earlier. And the thing is, you know, we've got our butts kicked in Afghanistan. We've lost that war. We just won't admit it. We got run out of Iraq. Al-Qaeda, which we were supposed to crush like a gnat, is popping up all over. We've had one reverse or defeat after another, There are a lot of people who are itching. They want to see us go and have a bring the Soviets back. They were fun to fight, and we're doing that to an extent with Russia. Putin, however, in Russia, Mr. Putin, former KGB agent, is too clever to fall for these provocations, and is being very cautious on what he's doing. Thank goodness, once again, we see that our fate is more in Putin's hands than it is in Obama's for the moment.
Mm-hmm. All right, very stupid question with only 30 seconds to answer it, but whatever happened to Prince Bandar, speaking of Al-Qaeda?
Well, Bandar's down there grumbling and gnashing his teeth because the U.S. won't more bomb Syria.
I mean, they're saying he's missing or something. He didn't show up at the big summit in D.C. or I forgot.
Well, there's a power struggle going on in Saudi Arabia. And he's the intelligence chief, too. So it's more likely he's holed up there chewing betel nuts and plotting.
All right, everybody. That's the great Eric Margulies. Thanks very much again for your time, Eric.
Cheers, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's Eric Margulies. EricMargulies.com, spelled like Margulies. LouRockwell.com, uns.com, UNZ, uns.com. We'll be right back. Oh, Marcy Wheeler's going to be on later, too. Maybe here in a second. Maybe in half an hour. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. Marcy Wheeler's coming up on the show. I actually get really nervous whenever I talk to her because I just don't know if I know enough to even ask her a question right or understand what she's saying. She gets so into the details of this. You know, it's like my friend who's, you know, got an advanced degree in mathematics from what you call it, university down there in Houston. And I tried to get him to explain some stuff to me about astrophysics and whatever one time. And he finally just quit and says, you know, I can't talk to you if you don't know the language of math. There's just no other way for me to explain to you, except with a bunch of equations. And since you don't get it, let's just not talk about it anymore. okay. That's kind of me reading Empty Wheel. Wait, what? Get way down into the weeds there, so. Anyway, she's also got, by the way, some really good co-authors there, including this guy, Jim White. And, you know, I think I gave up trying to get him on the show because for some reason he just doesn't do radio, or maybe he's always conflicted at my time or something. I forget now. But anyway, he's really good on Iran stuff. And there's not too many people who are very good on Iran stuff. But, yeah, I'd say he's better than me on Iran stuff as far as getting down into the details. He does good work here. This one is Dahl Reuters. That's D-A-H-L. Dahl Reuters grant anonymity to sources peddling Iran info rejected by the IAEA. So this is at emptywheel.net by Jim White from yesterday, the 27th. Back in October, I noted, he writes, that as the P5 plus one, that's the U.S. UN Security Council, U.S. Security Council, same difference, IAEA and Iran all move toward agreements on Iran's nuclear technology, the usual pathway employed by those who wish to disrupt peaceful talk and agitate toward military solutions, was remarkably silent. And then he goes on to talk about the worst of the war party loyal sock puppets in the media, the neo-crazy sycophants as the great Gordon Prather calls him. And so, of course, top alumni spot goes to George John of AP. I'm not sure, where's David Sanger on the list? I don't even see David Sanger on the list here. Has he fallen down on the job? Is David Sanger no longer the chairman of the Let's All Lie About Iran establishment in the American media? Well, I wonder what he did to get demoted. They started making him report with Mazzetti, and then the truth started showing up in his articles sometimes, and I guess it got him banished. Anyway, sorry. George John, he's a liar who writes for the Associated Press. He's not a journalist. He's a liar, and his job is telling lies to you to get you to believe lies. You know, so that you'll be bad on Iran. And anyway, and so he goes on to name, of course, Frederick Dahl of Reuters and Joby Warrick at the Washington Post, where these guys will always can be relied on to funnel a bunch of crap into the stream, especially just in time to disrupt the, some progress, whatever latest progress and whatever negotiations are attempted to be carried out, or people are attempting to carry out. So anyway, Jim White was noticing here that last fall when they got this done, George John and Frederick Dahl and Joby Warrick, they were kind of silent. David Sanger. They didn't come out and do everything they could to leak a bunch of lies and ruin the thing. And he says he took that at the time to mean that, these dogs not barking is an encouraging sign that there's so much optimism that this deal really could succeed, or at least they could succeed in getting a deal passed, that, these guys dare not be the ones to oppose it now. Well, so much for that, because here's Frederick Dahl in Reuters talking about how there was this annex to an IAEA report that didn't get published. Of course, the implication is that there was some kind of cover-up of all the dangerous new information. And of course, as Jim White points out, he completely neglects to mention even the possibility that the IAEA didn't include the accusations because there wasn't anything to them. Sadly, Frederick Dahl and Reuters have broken the silence from those who want to disrupt the talks, but even with this blatant attempt to derail negotiations, there are elements of hope. Dahl has granted anonymity to, quote, sources who tell him that the IAEA last year considered putting together a new report on Iran's nuclear activities, similar to the annex included in the 2011 report that prompted much controversy. After making only vague hints about what sort of evidence might have been in the report, Dahl then goes on to parrot the sources in saying the IAEA chose not to issue the new report because of warming relations between Iran and negotiating countries. He also states the IAEA had no comment, but he completely ignores the likelihood that the IAEA did not provide the new report because all the, quote, evidence in question was found not to be credible. Dahl and Reuters completely ignore the history of known false information being supplied to the IAEA and the ongoing process of new bits of information from the, quote, unquote, so-called laptop of death being leaked by the sources in question. Here is how Dahl's report frames the information being fed to him. Quote, the UN nuclear watchdog planned a major report on Iran that might have revealed more of its suspected atomic bomb research, but held off as Tehran's relations with the outside world thawed, sources familiar with the matter said. Such a report to have been prepared last year would almost certainly have angered Iran and complicated efforts to settle a decade-old dispute over atomic da-da-da. According to the sources, the IAEA has apparently dropped the idea of a new report, at least for the time being. There's no immediate comment from the IAEA, etc. The source said there was no way of knowing what information collected by the agency since it issued its landmark report on Iran in 2011 might have been incorporated in the new document. Although one said it could have added to worries about Tehran's activities. Really? I'm glad. I almost skipped that, but that's the punchline of the whole thing, right? There's no way of knowing what might have been in this report that they didn't publish. But we're pretty sure it must have, might have, could have been something really bad, huh? This Reuters reporter, Dahl, writes Jim White at EmptyWheel.net, relies completely on his sources, saying that the IAEA chose not to issue the report so as not to anger Iran, without considering that the IAEA very likely found the new information to be neither new nor credible. A bit further in the piece, we get a vague description of what the, quote, new information might have been. Quote, this is now Jim White quoting Reuters again. The sources, who declined to be identified due to the sensitivity of the issue, suggested more recent material concerned extra detail about alleged research and experiments that were covered in the November 2011 report. A new report would probably have included, quote, updated information on PMD, which could have reinforced the concern about Iran, one said. One source said it was believed that the Vienna-based IAEA had received more information on suspicions of nuclear yield calculations, but it was not known to what extent this would have made it into a new report on Iran. Boy, that's a lot of unknowns to write an article around, isn't it, Mr. Dahl? But then Jim White continues here, ah, the nuclear yield calculations. I would have thought that Dahl's sources would have given up on that long ago. See this analysis by Yosef Butt for a detailed retrospective of the last time the issue of these calculations came up and how the graph released at that time was shown to almost certainly be a fabrication. Further, Butt shows in the article that the IAEA even relied on this fabrication in the 2011 report annex. In a more recent opinion piece, Butt showed how the IAEA's behavior has complicated the Iran nuclear issue. But I take in heart the fact that the IAEA clearly was urged last year to add to the 2011 annex and chose not to do so. Despite the framing preferred by Dahl sources, I would even go so far as to say that the IAEA found this new evidence not to be credible enough to include in a new report. And that would have made this new evidence especially shaky, since much of the material from 2011 has been thoroughly debunked. Just last week, in my, that's Jim White at EmptyWheel.net, post describing the framework that is now in place for the P5+1 to negotiate a final agreement with Iran, I remarked on the statement from Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif that neither side will surprise the other with new claims. Quote, that must come as a huge disappointment to the crews in Israel and the U.S. intelligence operations who, quote, find new documents whenever they need to disrupt diplomatic progress. If the best this crew can do at the current time is to complain about new information they tried to foist on the IAEA last year, I'd say things are moving along very well at this point. Very well taken. And I got to tell you, I'm very happy that it's February the 28th because that means it's darn near March. And that means I can get Yosef Butt back on the show. Yosef Butt, I think, is right now the best anti-war voice we have, or the best factual voice we have on the truth of Iran's nuclear program and the history of the negotiations concerning it, etc. He really is great, and he's been writing a lot lately, and he'll be back and back on this show very soon. But that was Jim White at EmptyWheel.net. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Coming up, Marcy Wheeler, the great. And I'm going to ask her some stuff. She's going to explain the answers. It's going to be awesome. All right, now, I got to tell you how I screwed up the Tom Woods interview. I don't know if you heard it. I thought I did pretty good on the Ukraine part, man. I don't know. It was pretty good. But so here's what happened. I recorded the interview yesterday, and so half the interview was about Ukraine, and then the other half of the interview was about Iraq. Well, part of my answer about Iraq, I mean, I don't even know anymore how bad I screwed this up, but part of my answer about Iraq was, well, of course, you know, it was all about Israel. It's what Ariel Sharon wanted, and therefore it's what the Israel lobby and the neoconservatives in America wanted, and they're a bunch of stupid idiots. They thought they were going to get a Hashemite king, at least at first, and then later they thought they would have Ahmed Chalabi as their guy. And then that didn't work out, and it turned out they just empowered Iran and then fought a giant war for their enemies, basically. For an enemy that if you had asked Ariel Sharon, he would have told you he hated Iran a hell of a lot more than Saddam Hussein. But anyway. But then I also brought up the Yanan plan and the coping with crumbling states and the theory that, you know, the right-wing nationalists of Israel would prefer to just have a bunch of warring tribes and the end of nationalism in the Middle East altogether and whatever, whatever. And the problem is, I mean, I don't even know, man. Maybe if I just went back and listened to it, it would have been fine. But it seemed like I didn't really explain it very well. That, yeah, on one hand, they want dictatorship everywhere, including a Hashemite kingdom in Iraq if they can get one, and all of this. But at the same time, they want to end the nation states altogether and all these permanent warring tribes and Michael Ledeen's boiling cauldron. And it sounded kind of contradictory because I don't think I qualified it very well, which is that, well, you know, they'll take a dictatorship and stability if they can get it, but then again, they'll settle for permanent revolution and chaos and madness like in Iraq, like the Iraq War, and like what's going on in Syria right now. Second place, obviously the Israelis, the neocons, and the Israel lobby prefer military dictatorship in Egypt. So it's not all, you know, some, you know, Egypt the prize. Remember that? Richard Pearl's friend, Laurent Mirowick, saying Iraq is the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia, gotta invade them, that's the strategic pivot, and then Egypt is the prize. Let's just completely destroy all these nations entirely. Do what we want and never have them even look at us funny again, kind of attitude. Us being the Israelis from that point of view. But anyway, so, you know, it's hard in an answer, and I thought, well, I don't know, I kind of thought that maybe it's going to sound bad. I didn't qualify it right. I didn't really explain what I meant well. And so I asked Tom to let me re-record my answer. But then in my re-recorded answer, I kind of replaced not what I already said with a finer-tuned version. I actually gave the answer before that again about the Civil War in Iraq and all this stuff. So he pasted my second try at that answer in there, and then it was completely redundant and terrible and stupid. I don't know if anybody noticed. Hey, didn't he just say that like a minute and a half ago or something? Yeah, that's because I screwed up. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to just try to edit it a little bit until it sucks a little bit less, and then that will be the permanent version up there. I can't stand having secrets, man. I'd rather just tell the truth, you know? The truth is that I was right, but I didn't explain it well, and I tried to fix it, and I made it even worse. Poor Tom. He ought to just run the Ukraine part and just interview me about Iraq some other time. I'll start all over from scratch, man. I'm such a damn fool sometimes. Anyway, I'm absolutely 100% good on Iraq, by the way. I'm just not very good at explaining it, I guess. Well, some of the time. All right. Well, so anyway, I figured I did something stupid. I owe it to you to let me know. I owe it to me to let you know how stupid I am. Not sure why, but okay, good. Now I'm going to say something else. I can't get Bob Higgs on the show. He's just a busy guy, and I don't think he really likes doing radio anyway. I think he likes me all right, but I don't think he likes doing radio. And he's a very busy guy. He's Bob Higgs, for crying out loud. He's 12 feet tall. But I did have a chance to sit down and have breakfast with him at that Students for Liberty thing. And there's a lot of people talking about a lot of stuff, but I got to ask him some questions. I mentioned before to you about how he kind of inspired my line of thinking about just how the American people's attitude is changing about government because of cell phone video cameras and YouTube and Facebook, and how the American people, without relying on our NBC affiliate, the American people are all making national news stories and even international news stories about each and every videotaped incident of police abuse of regular Americans. Like, we're all a bunch of Rodney King. I saw a thing about the history of rap today, and they showed the Rodney King footage and what a big deal that was back then. Nowadays, like, yeah, of course, dude. Not that we're doing anything about it, just, but there's no shock, there's no surprise anymore. That's just how it is for everybody. You don't have to be a black to be subject to that stuff. A black, you know what I'm saying? You don't have to be black to be subject to that. Not by the LAPD or any other PD, I don't think. But, anyway, Higgs also, I asked him, hey man, does anybody have a good point? I mean, and Bob Higgs is the kind of guy who, he's a giant in this field, but he's also a very humble sort of guy. He'd be perfectly happy to acknowledge each and every hole in his theory that he hasn't quite patched up yet, if he had one, you know? He's really good like that. And I asked him, does anybody have any kind of reasonable competing theory of the business cycle? Explanation of why we have in our economy this massive boom and the massive bust, time after time. And so we go through them. I mean, I know a little bit about this stuff, and I was asking him about some other theories of the business cycle that I've read about and what have you. And what it came down to was no. Because, see, it's the business cycle theory, the Austrian business cycle theory, isn't even necessarily really a business cycle theory at all. It's the theory of the unsustainable boom. That's all it is. And what's bust about it is that it's unsustainable and it always fails. And the answer to the question of what causes this is always the same, each and every time. And it's the artificial expansion of bank credit by the central bank. Well, ultimately, yeah, the artificial expansion of bank credit. But it's only possible on the scale that it's carried out now, of course, because of America's central banking system. And so, that's what we have. A massive boom, and then a massive bust. And then a massive boom, and then a massive bust. Over and over again. And of course, this all coincides with our wars. I mean, I guess they gotta inflate no matter what anyway. They don't know what else to do but build up another bubble each time it pops. But they gotta make those wars seem free. They're never gonna raise your taxes at wartime again. If they ever did. Maybe during World War I. But they inflated for World War I too. But especially when you're talking about these wars of imperial conquest, they're never going to come to you with an Iraq-style invasion and say, we got to raise your price. Remember, right after the invasion, after it was already a done deal and the 3rd Infantry Division was occupying Baghdad and Saddam Hussein was on the run, then they announced, oh yeah, by the way, our first Iraq appropriations bill needs to be for $87 billion. And the American people went, what? I thought you said the oil was going to pay for it. I thought you said the war is going to be free. And they said, don't worry, here's your rebate check, $300 in the mail for you. Here's your dividend for letting us have this war. Here's your payoff, Americans, $300 stimulus check, they called it. But still, that price, $87 billion. Of course, 10 times that would be only one-fifth of the cost of that Iraq war. You realize that? 10 times would be $870 billion, not quite a trillion. And the Iraq War is the $5 trillion war, at least according to Joe Stiglitz, who's one of these print money all day guys, but still, I'm pretty sure he's good at accounting. It was him and Linda Bilmes, I believe is how you say her name. I think it's the best I know how to say her name. Anyway, they calculated it was $3 trillion. They wrote a book called The $3 Trillion War. And then they came out with this piece for the Washington Post called, sorry, everybody, actually, we forgot to calculate this, that, and the other thing, and it's going to be more like $5 trillion. Well, they got to print that money. They got to expand bank credit to create the boom that they can tax enough revenue and use and sell enough bonds that they can have a war like that. Can you guys all hear the dog panting? I got to get her out of here, man. Tell me, chat room, can you hear the dog panting? Shh. Marcy Wheeler coming up here in just a second. But yeah, it's the unsustainable boom. And here's my real point about this. I don't know who else listens to the show. I'm talking to myself in here. But basically, what I like to believe is that there's conservatives and there's liberals and there's libertarians and there's people who don't really know what any of those things really mean anyway and don't care too much about all that and just who knows who, right? And somebody's mom, somebody's auntie. And so here's the thing. You don't have to believe in any other thing that libertarians believe at all. You don't have to believe in natural rights. You don't have to believe in peace. You don't have to believe in, voluntary exchange of any kind for charity or for industry or for anything. But you have to agree with us about the unsustainable boom. You know why? Because only the libertarians are right about it. That's it. Mises.org. Independent.org. The unsustainable boom is caused by the government-backed expansion of bank credit, which leads business in America to believe, and around the world, to believe that there's more wealth for investing than there really is, which means they invest in projects which can't be completed, which means they won't be, which means there will be a crash, and so it goes. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first-ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is the great Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, they call her on the internet. That's emptywheel.net, and also at Empty Wheel there on Twitter. A lot of fun to follow. Welcome back to the show. Marcy, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing real good. Hey, do me a favor and put in a good word for me with Jim White, because he's really good on Iran, and I want to ask him about it.
I will do.
Cool, thank you. Hey, listen, what I meant to say before that was, first of all, congratulations. Not so much to you, though, but to Glenn Greenwald and to whoever's in on this, Scahill, and whoever all is in on this Intercept project and First Look Media. Congratulations to them for hiring you. I don't know exactly what your title is, but I imagine your job is making sure that they're right about everything. And so I hope they're paying you $1 million a year. You're certainly worth it. And it's got to be the best move they could have possibly made, was bringing you on board there. That's what I think.
That is an amazing statement. It is, at this point, a limited relationship, but I'm really excited about it. There are so many great people over there.
Cool. Well, I sure hope that... Well, I hope they run everything they publish by first. That's what I would do if I could, you know? So, good deal. Welcome back to the show. Congrats to you and to them. Now, tell me this. There's a lot of things to talk about. And I should let you pick a lot of the priority. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about, first of all, here, was about the claim made by the state back in a couple of weeks ago, I guess now. I forget, USA Today or whatever it was, where they says, you know what? Everything you've heard up until now is wrong anyway. We have not been collecting all your metadata. We've only been collecting about 20% of the metadata anyway. And I'm wondering if you think that maybe that's right, or if it's not, what's the significance of that either way?
I think it could be narrowly correct. And by narrowly correct, I mean, I think that it is possible that right now, under the Section 215 program, the providers, there were three in July. Let's assume there are still three, but even that may not be true. The providers, if they were providing just their own, the phone calls of their own customers, might only be providing 30% of the calls in the United States. So, and the numbers varied, actually. There was 20, there was 30. Keith Alexander has since said, no, that's not true. So in other words, if you time delimit it, if you say right now they're only getting 30%, if you assume that none of the providers, not AT&T and not Verizon, are also providing the other calls that transit their backbones, which we know in the past they were doing, if you assume that we're only talking about Section 215 data and not the larger phone dragnet, of which Section 215 is a tiny bit, and if you're also talking, I think that There are a number of legal issues that have happened since the Snowden leak started. On July 19th, one of the judges in the FISA court said, you can't collect location data with this. And at that point, any provider who didn't want to have to play anymore could just say, sorry, I can't give you my data except with the cell location data, and then they could stop providing. And if I were Verizon, that's what I would have done. Another interesting thing is that since the Snowden leak started, Verizon and Vodafone have decided to and have effectively split up. And so it's possible that the government was getting a lot of the data that it did get from Verizon, but offshore, because Verizon was part of a temporary program, which GCHQ required because Verizon could require Verizon's involvement because they were a UK company and they were getting massive amounts of metadata. That's not true. I mean, it may not be true anymore because Verizon is no longer a UK company.
Right.
And then there are a couple of other issues. But so that's the point is it cannot be true. It is probably impossible to be true for the life of the program. And just as an example, they say one of the providers that is not providing data is T-Mobile. And the only person they have ever busted using Section 215, the only one, the Sally Molin, who's a Somali-American out in San Diego, uses T-Mobile. Most likely person between him and the Somali warlords that they contact chained on also uses T-Mobile. So if they weren't getting T-Mobile call data, they would never have found Basali Molin, or maybe they found Basali Molin using data from another source. And so I think that's part of what's going on. And I think that's
the case that they cite as the one time that they caught a terrorist with this thing, and he was really just sending some money back to Somalia was all.
And not even to support terrorism. I mean, he basically was trying to fight a U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. So, yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of things, and I haven't written them all up into a post, but I think it is possible, legally possible, narrowly. Just as another example, there's zero reason to believe they've got Skype data yet.
That they've got which
Section
kind?
Under Section 215.
I'm sorry, there's no reason to believe they've gotten what yet?
Skype.
Oh.
And that's going to be a lot of international phone calls. That's how I call my mother-in-law in Ireland. But we're talking Section 215. We have no reason to believe Microsoft has been part of Section 215, but you know what? Microsoft is part of FISA Amendments Act, PRISM, and they could get the data that way. So in other words, there's a lot of other ways they can get this data, and it is impossible to believe that they're only getting 30% of the U.S. phone records because we know they're getting so much data overseas that involves U.S. persons. Mm-hmm.
Well, their whole excuse here, there's so many issues here to discuss, but their whole excuse is that, listen, we have to collect it all or else we won't have the haystack to go and dig through. And so they're really undermining their entire argument if they really want to claim that this is true, that somehow they can only data mine 30% of us and then that qualifies somehow. And then I forgot what my other thing was going to be there. They're debunking themselves if they want us to believe this, right?
And then conveniently, the other thing that's going on is that in a couple of the lawsuits, so for example, Larry Klayman, the head of Judicial Watch, mm-hmm. who won his suit in D.C. and it's being appealed, he's not a Verizon landline subscriber. He's a Verizon cell phone subscriber. And so the convenient thing about this leak is that now they're going to challenge Klayman's standing. They're going to challenge the standing of some people in the suit in California. So in other words, it's a really convenient explanation. And if everything was honest, then I think we could also go to them and say, look, you know, either they're doing it with Section 215, or they're doing it with FAA, or they're doing it with other authorities, all of which are possible, but the point is they have this dragnet that they're collecting, and if they're doing it with other authorities, they're even legally more suspect than they are with Section 215. And I think there's, you know, there's increasing reason to believe that that's true.
Well, and at this point, we can pretty much take it as kind of a rule of thumb that if they ever say that we are not doing X, Y, or Z under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, that all they really mean to say is they are doing it under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, or they're doing it over under Executive Order 12333, or some other thing maybe that we don't even know about yet, but there's virtually no line that they haven't, that we've found them to refuse to cross yet, right?
Right. I mean, there was an interesting, this is not actually new, but it's new to me. So there's a woman, Caroline Craft, who is right now the acting head of OLC at DOJ. So she's the one who tells Obama whether he can kill somebody with a drone, mm-hmm. Kill an American with a drone, which is, you know, the other big question. She's also up for being the general counsel of CIA. And Ron Wyden asked her really, you know, one of those classic Ron Wyden questions, following up on her confirmation hearing in December. He said, look, there was this May 6, 2004 Jack Goldsmith opinion. Can you tell me whether it authorized phone dragnet collection not under Section 215? And we know it did. We know that for 2 years, you know, from May 2004 until May of 2006, we know that the phone dragnet continued based only on that opinion that Jack Goldsmith wrote, and it continued without the FISA court approval that it subsequently got. So we know that he makes some argument in there, which remains classified, that basically says the executive branch can approve getting phone dragnet without any kind of court review whatsoever. So Wyden asks Caroline Craft, he says, well, is that still active? She's like, well, we can't withdraw it. There's no reason to withdraw it. So it's an active OLC memo. She's like, but don't worry, we're not relying on it. And then earlier this week, there was a hearing for somebody else, doesn't matter who. But both Dianne Feinstein, and you know it's serious, as Dianne Feinstein says it, both Dianne Feinstein and Mark Udall are like asking the nominee, they're like, tell me about your oversight role, DOJ person. Tell me about your oversight role on 12333, which is the stuff collected overseas. He's like, no, we don't have one. You know, so she wouldn't know. Like, there's this whole area where DOJ doesn't have visibility into what NSA is doing, and it's precisely that area where there's this still active memo saying that the executive branch doesn't need any of this, you know, legal authorization.
Yeah, and that's because of the original authorization to use military force, or no, this executive order goes back to Ronald Reagan, so this is just the plenary power of the inherent authority of the president, as David Addington would put it, or something like that, right?
An excellent David Addington interpretation. I love it.
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, in other words, we can't find it in Article 2, but all you need to know is the president is the commander-in-chief, and so that's all you need to know. He can do whatever he wants. And what are you going to do? Stop him? That's what I thought.
It always comes down to that. What are you going to do? Stop him?
Yeah, exactly. Like a schoolyard bully. What are you going to do about it? Uh-huh. Just like when Bush, when the New York Times finally published the story in December 05 by Lick, Blau, and Risen about the Bush program, he gave a speech the next day, went out and did a press conference the next day where he goes, yeah, I'm guilty of millions of counts of violations of the felony FISA Act. What are you going to do about it? And the Congress was like, nothing. You're the boss, dude. You're the decider. And that was it. That's all he had to do, was just say, what? All right. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm just running out the clock because we've got to take this stupid break. And then we'll be back with the heroic Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, they call her on the internet, emptywheel.net. And also on Twitter. We'll be back in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the phone with Marcy Wheeler from EmptyWheel.net. And you can follow her on Twitter, too, Empty Wheel there. And now, let's see, there's so much to talk about. Well, let me make sure that you didn't have anything else to finish up on the prior topics there on the different authorities that these, you know, different spying against the American people has carried out and that kind of thing before we move on. Was there anything there?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
All right. I'm never sure because this stuff is so complicated. You know, who knows?
Tell me because I don't even know what I can't even see anymore. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, I could understand. You might need to take a vacation, go parasailing or something a little bit, come back, fresh perspective. But no, I mean, you do a bang up job here. I don't know anybody who's as good at it. So let me ask you about this latest Greenwald piece at The Intercept. That's firstlook.org/The Intercept, of course. How covert agents infiltrate the internet to manipulate, deceive, and destroy reputations. And I was hoping you could, well, fisk it in a good way, you know what I mean? Kind of take us through here, because it's a pretty long, complicated thing. And so I was hoping you could explain, you know, what it is they're doing, and then as far as we know so far, to what extent they're doing the horrible things described in these documents and in this article.
Well, and I should say that I haven't gotten any more access into those particular documents than anybody else has. So, I can't pretend to have read everything in depth.
Although, I mean, they published a whole slideshow. I don't know if you read the whole thing. I didn't.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they published quite a bit there about it.
I mean, I think what's really important about that story is that we expect the CIA to do stuff like that. We expect the CIA to go overseas and infiltrate groups and carry out kind of covert things to get people to, you know, to win elections that otherwise wouldn't be won, and so on and so forth. And what we're seeing really is not only the NSA setting up that possibility online, I should say GCHQ, because that's actually GCHQ, although some of the other, I mean, remember we saw months ago, it was a Greenwald story, but it was at Huffington Post, where they talked about collecting data on people perceived as enemies of the United States, but not terrorists, although they were kind of radical Muslims. They had kind of tangential ties to terrorists, but the NSA was collecting this information to discredit these people. You know, we're going to find out how much porn they view online. Now we know they can do it via their webcam. We're going to find out what kind of speaking fees they're getting. We're going to find, you know, so we've seen that in operation already at the NSA. And what the story that Glenn did kind of shows in more detail is the degree to which, I mean, they're basically throwing lots of social science at it. They're throwing old spy techniques, and they're bringing it all online. And they're bringing it, you know, they're bringing it online. And, you know, I think this has been clear for quite some time that, you know, Twitter especially, how many people do you interact with on Twitter who are clearly, you know, paid shills or moles or what have you, and people who are trying to cyber instigate, right? And they're trying to sow dissension among the left or among the libertarians or among what have you. And so we've seen that for quite some time. And I think what that document showed is the behind the scenes, the confirmation that behind the scenes they are doing just that. And that it's no longer, it's not like NSA sets up a neat network and CIA does it. NSA is doing it itself. So this notion that, and I think that's one of the things we're seeing more generally is NSA, you know, once upon a time break the Soviet codes and try and keep us safe. And as their role has become amorphous, they're doing all this kind of creepy stuff, and they have access to all our personal data, which is the really dangerous. Mm-hmm.
Well, and they seem to have shown numerous ways that they're willing to conflate just about anything with terrorism. I mean, if you participate in politics in any way other than just going and joining your local branch of the Democratic or Republican Party, then they very well may consider whatever it is that you're doing a crime under, you know, whatever perversion of law.
Right, and it's not just terrorism because they're going to go after anonymous, after people deemed to be hackers. And there's a lot of people, Jeremy Hammond, there's a lot of people on the borders of hacking culture who play a very different role, and they've already been prosecuted. And you have to wonder to what degree was NSA involved in collecting the data, to what degree is NSA involved in sowing dissent in anonymous. You know, we've seen that they do go after anonymous. And even if you agree that anonymous should be thrown in jail tomorrow, there's a lot of legal behavior that gets dubbed as anonymous as well. And the NSA is not, they're applying this, this guilt by association that they adopted in the terrorism context, and frankly, to a large degree in the drug war context, and they're applying it now with new kinds of applications. And hacking is, I think, I don't want to say hacking's worst, because it's almost like more white people are going to be affected when they start going after hackers than when they're going after Muslim terrorism or the drug war, because the white people in the drug war always never get prosecuted. But I also think there's another dangerous side to it, because it's so much, it's not necessarily so much closer to speech than a lot of the Muslims they're going after, but it can be. And so we're seeing this morph, and it's morphing at the same time as the NSA just continues to collect all of this data about all of us, and we never know at what point, sometime in the future, stuff we do now is going to be deemed illegal, and therefore, the networks that we have now are going to criminalize us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, boy, two or three hops can mean just about anything, right? if you know Steve Clemens, then you know a guy who knows a guy who once met with Osama bin Laden himself.
Yeah, exactly. Or, I can't count the number of ways I'm 2 degrees away from Edward Snowden now.
Right.
Who, is a subject of a spy investigation, and therefore, and Bart Gellman has said that he was told that his phone records were collected using a national security letter. So, mm-hmm. you get swept up there pretty easily. So, and you get swept up, I've never talked to Edward Snowden. But I'm still going to get sucked up into this dragnet, sure.
Don't be afraid. You're doing the right thing. But yeah, the point is, if you were, X, Y, or Z other journalists too, or anybody else, that they've got no right to do that to you. Not whatsoever to ever try to criminalize what it is you're doing for straight up Benjamin Franklin work, First Amendment work here. Now, and what's funny too? Is always hear these conspiracy theorists saying, the whole Edward Snowden thing is a modified limited hangout. Because all he's doing is proving that every suspicion we ever had about these guys in our most fevered nightmares was true. And so, therefore, we already knew all this. Except, no, what he's doing, he's really putting, here's the slide about how they fracture your political movement. Identifying and exploiting fracture points. Let's make a little flow chart of how to list the things people disagree about, how to rank them in priority of importance, and then how to make, them mad at each other and no longer cooperate. Here it is right here in PowerPoint for you. Your worst conspiracy theories about what the state has in store for you in this so-called democracy, right here in pastels, in living color.
And at that level, we talk a lot about American constitutional guarantees and what have you. But at that level, I really think that's where a lot of Americans miss the impact of this, which is that the U.S. is the hegemon. It is the most powerful country in the world. It is the richest country in the world, although, with shoddy finances. It is structurally the best situated country to spy in the world. And it's not just our dissent. It's not just our political organizations that they are going to go in and corrupt. It's the opposition, the legitimate opposition to U.S. power in other countries, in Mexico, in Venezuela, in you know, France in mm-hmm. in Africa, and do we really want the NSA to be doing what the CIA could do in much more limited fashion and always botched anyway, and do it all online and poison the international online community in doing so? And that's, I think, the other question that really needs to be asked.
Right. Yeah, it does. You're right. It gets lost in what they're doing to the Americans, which they always try to argue is technically legal, even though they're obviously stretching the definition of collect and relevant and imminent and whatever other word they want to destroy. But clearly it's all unconstitutional, un-American behavior, and it's affecting us, and we're the Americans, and so that's the part that we pick on the most. And for me, it's really annoying to hear them making such a scandal about tapping Angela Merkel. Screw her. She doesn't have any rights. She's a head of a state. I'm not worried about her, but yeah, the people of Germany, they have a right to be secure in their person's houses, papers, and effects, too. And they should not have to live under the tyranny of the American panopticon just because they're not from here.
Yeah, and then, you know, the notion that James Clapper can decide globally what the legitimate bounds of descent to U.S. power is, is terrifying, because I don't, you know, the guy has a tin ear. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't even understand American politics from everything I can see, much less, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're clearly right. I mean, he was the hack pushing the Saddam's chemical weapons are in Syria line back then. He may have even believed that he's so dumb. I'd believe he believed it. Stupid lie. Anyway, thank you so much for your time, Marcy. It's great to talk to you as always.
Great to talk to you.
I appreciate it very much. That's Marcy Wheeler, everybody. EmptyWheel.net. Read that blog all day, every day. See you tomorrow. I mean, Monday.